So, welcome back to another episode of Wise Words Book Summaries. Today we're doing part two of Think Faster, Talk Smarter. So in the first part, we've already covered the six steps to better spontaneous speaking, which was calm, unlock, redefine, listen, structure, and focus. This part two of the book provides practical applications for the lessons of spontaneous communication. So in this part, we're going to cover small talk and networking, tips for giving toasts, how to improve your pitching, nailing a Q&A session, how to give feedback that doesn't flop, and the secret formula to create an apology. This section will cover specific structures you can use, as well as tips and tricks for each application. As you remember from the first part, structure serves the same purpose as a chef's preparation. By selecting a recipe, our structure, contemplating it, and prepping it by chopping, slicing, and arranging ingredients ahead of time, all that remains to be done in the moment is to put the dish together. So with that all being said, we'll go on to application number one, going big on small talk. So networking and small talk, the pinnacle of impromptu communication, often leave many feeling uneasy. Starting and ending these quick, casual conversations can be awkward. In the midst of these interactions, it's common to struggle with finding the right words. While we aim to come across as clever and engaging, making effortless communication at various social gatherings, from casual get-togethers and company meetings, to professional conferences and school events, it can feel like a relentless exchange of spontaneous comments, questions, and responses. However, it doesn't have to be this challenging. So one of the key points he sort of wanted to talk about in this chapter was talking about others. So we need to start our conversations with genuine curiosity about the other person. Comment on your surroundings or situation can kickstart a dialogue. The aim is to build a connection by showing interest in their experience or views. In casual chats, you need to aim to make the most of your speaking turns by focusing on the other person rather than yourself, something I'm sure we all struggle with to some extent.
Yeah.
People enjoy talking about themselves and feeling understood. So by steering the conversation towards them, you create a more engaging and meaningful exchange. Lastly, you need to balance the conversation by sharing about yourself while focusing on the other person. Aiming for a mix of mostly supportive responses with a few about yourself can create a well-rounded and engaging interaction. And I think later on we might go over it, but there was a sort of a rule or a heuristic to use here, which was something like three parts about somebody else to one part about yourself. I think they were sort of suggesting, because obviously if you make it all about them, it becomes a bit like more of a therapy session and should be aimed to be avoided.
Yes. Yeah. So on to the next part then.
Yes.
So support others' stories and ideas. Experts recommend responding in ways that support the speaker instead of redirecting the conversation to yourself. For example, after someone shares a story, ask questions like, "What excited you about that?" or "How did you feel?" This encourages them to share more and deepens the conversation. And I think we've touched on this before in regard to like open and close questions, but you want to kind of dive into how they felt about something that is more meaningful to them. Yes, they're telling you about the facts of something, but you want to get their opinion on it. You want to get how they experienced it, what they felt, because it's just, that's what most people actually like to talk about. So the next point, avoid common answers. If asked a common question, avoid cliche answers. Offer an interesting detail about yourself to encourage further questions, then shift the focus back to them with supportive responses. I believe we kind of talked about this yesterday when we were talking about, coming up with a random kind of answer to something instead of just your heuristic, which is like, how are you? Yeah, I'm fine. You come up with something new that kind of, piques their interest and shocks them out of the normal groove that people fall into when they converse with each other.
Yeah.
All right. So next point is leave gracefully. Making a smooth exit from conversations means leaving the other person feeling valued. Rather than excusing yourself for personal reasons alone, combine it with a question that shows you've listened and appreciated the chat. This approach ensures a graceful departure, making the other person feel acknowledged. Here are some tips for small talk. Tip one, actually, I just want to talk about, I quite like that idea, leaving the other person valued when you leave a conversation. I think that's actually quite an important point, because you leave on a high note and everyone kind of knows that, yes, okay, first impressions are a big thing, but also when you leave them as well, I think that's also something that you tend to remember the beginning and the end of a conversation. I think it's quite an important point, actually. I
No, it is. To be fair, what you said there about the sort of beginning and end, the peak end rule sort of thing, he definitely mentions it. And he was saying as well that it can even be something along the lines of like, oh, you know, I really enjoy talking to you. It was so interesting to hear about chat soon or something like that, you know, something to make them feel like, oh, wow, they actually enjoyed that conversation and they listened because you've repeated back to them, you know, the topic of what you talked about.
Exactly.
I think, it's. Yeah, very, like, it's something we don't do naturally, but it should probably be something we do more naturally because, you know, people are always going to appreciate sort of kind word at the end to be like, you know, I really enjoy chatting to you. They're not going to be like, oh, this guy, fuck this guy, you know?
Yeah, 100%. No, I like that. I'm gonna implement that. All right, so here are some tips for small talk. Tip one.
Seek
comparable levels of self-disclosure. While it's crucial to center the conversation on the other person, sharing about ourselves is also necessary. Aim for a balance. A rough guideline would be it would be 3 supportive responses for every one that shifts the focus back to ourselves. And that's kind of what you were talking about just before, wasn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I think it's such a good point because I remember reading around Stoicism. And they were always kind of saying, like, don't talk about yourself, don't bring attention to yourself. And I guess maybe the reason is, like, don't bring attention to yourself purely for the sake of gaining attention. But if you have something to offer, then offer it. But I kind of implemented it for a bit. And I felt that sometimes the conversations that I would have with people would kind of dry up and would kind of die. And sometimes they need a bit of, like, energy, a bit of life bred into them. And I do think that, you know, if you contribute as well, then they also have something else to go off and it gives them plenty of content to, you know, ask questions or follow that journey. So I do think it is something that's quite important.
Well, I was going to just quickly add is it's probably quite good to link what they're saying to you back to maybe one of your experiences so you can show that you can either understand them or you can build on it.
Yeah.
Not in a way, obviously, that classic like one-upmanship is like, oh, you went skiing there. Well, I went skiing here. Awesome. Like, not like that.
And we all know those people.
Yeah. But so more just trying to add, I guess, value or trying to make a connection that shows to them that you either understand them or maybe gives them a bridge into a separate conversation. It's not like one-upmanship, but it's more, you know, dancing together in a way.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, so tip 2 then. Avoid putting your partner on the spot. Matt Abrahams emphasizes the importance of framing conversations around the other person through thoughtful questioning. Avoid any approach that might feel confrontational or overly intrusive. Direct questions such as, how long have you worked at your current company, can make the conversation feel more like an interview than a casual chat. He suggests using open-ended questions that lead to positive discussions like, what do you enjoy doing when you're not here? Abrahams also advises adopting a gently self-deprecating tone, which is often perceived as more relatable and charming. Instead of criticizing others or the situation, a self-deprecating comment like, I'm glad I'm not the only one who struggles to make a good pasta sauce, can create a more engaging and comfortable conversational environment. Good point. Yeah.
Yeah. Great example. Great example.
Funny example. But yes, I do think that it like allows them to kind of calm, you know, when you're when you're slightly self-deprecating, you kind of show that you're not a threat.
And yeah, you model the behavior that you don't take yourself too seriously, don't you? Like, I remember from the How to Have Impossible Conversations about like modeling the behavior you want them to showcase. And if you can show that you don't take yourself too seriously, I think they become calmer as a consequence because they know they can be more themselves. You're not going to be like judging them because you're obviously judging yourself in a way that's like, you know, I was not going to say favorable, but you're being nice to yourself in the sense by saying, you know, even by judging yourself and making fun of yourself, you're showing that you don't hold yourself to a standard that you're going to be judging them through. Maybe it's probably a way of putting it.
Yeah, exactly. And it disarms them, which is nice. But then you can go too far. I think we all know people that self-deprecate and then it's like, oh, that sounds a bit too much.
It sounds a bit like a Freudian slip.
Yes. Yeah. Like, do you want my help? Is that what you're asking for?
Do you need Jesus?
Yeah. All right, so tip three then. Be a team player. Rather than seeing small talk as a battle of wits between individuals, it's more constructive to view it as a collaborative effort, aiming for mutual enjoyable outcome. Think of it as playing hacky sack together. The goal is to keep the conversation ball in the air, and if it falls, everyone misses out on the opportunity for connection. A practical approach to foster this cooperative spirit is to begin our contributions by echoing what our conversation partner has shared, demonstrating active listening and building on the exchange. And we've kind of come across this in terms of like mirroring, haven't we? Where you kind of like ask back what they said, or you like paraphrase what they've said to show that you've been listening, essentially.
Moving on to tip four, avoid swiping left too soon. So a common challenge in small talk is not being fully present in conversations, often resulting from scanning the room distractedly, anxious about missing out on potentially more engaging discussions elsewhere. It's kind of weird, to be honest. I've never really felt like, oh, they look like they're having a really nice conversation over there. I better leave. So this leads to a hurried, structured response and the use of superficial excuses to exit interactions prematurely. So it's helpful to remember that individuals might need a few minutes to feel comfortable enough to engage meaningfully. As a strategy, challenge yourself to remember one key fact about each person you meet, or encourage everyone to share their views on a specific subject, fostering deeper and more attentive conversations. And I think that's quite true about the whole people feeling comfortable enough to sort of engage more. I think, especially in conversations I've been in, obviously there's some people out there who are willing to almost get straight stuck into the, you know, the meat of a conversation immediately. And there's some people that take a bit of warming up to really hear, you know, how they feel about things and, you know, how their life's going and stuff. And I think that almost is always based upon, to some degree, the level of trust they have that you're not going to judge them as well. So I think if you can obviously start a conversation with some self-deprecation or showcase that you're a trustworthy individual as soon as possible, then you're more likely to get into the sort of meat and potatoes. Whatever I hear that quote, I can't. The meat and potatoes.
I know.
I'm not thinking of Sean Strickland. Like, it's not good. Not good at all. I believe this is the last tip, and it is. So tip number five, minimize your chances of offending others by reflecting, questioning, and paraphrasing. So when starting a conversation, it's important not to jump to conclusions about the opinions others might have. Listen carefully to the content, detail, and tone of what is being shared. If you're contributing to the discussion, begin with broad questions rather than strong statements that demand immediate agreement or disagreement. Using paraphrasing can keep the dialogue flowing smoothly by allowing you to ask for more details on a topic without imposing your own perspective. For example, asking, can you expand upon your views about da-da-da? And then summarizing their response helps understand their perspective better. This approach can lead to a more meaningful exchange by reducing the emotional stakes. Studies indicate that showing willingness to consider different viewpoints enhances our ability to connect, learn, and avoid conflicts in conversations. People are more receptive when they feel their opinions are respected and listened to with an open mind. Demonstrating conversational receptiveness through acknowledging shared views, moderating statements, and focusing on positive comments can make interactions more constructive and enjoyable. This involves explicitly recognizing others' viewpoints, finding commonalities, and expressing understanding, which encourages a more open and productive exchange. I mean, what we just said there is exactly what we were saying before about the sort of paraphrasing and repeating back to people what they've just said.
Yeah.
I think it's interesting more about the tone and not making blanket agreement, disagreement statements. More maybe of like a yes, I agree and, or in fact, you wouldn't even go yes, I disagree and. But anyway, I think it's more the tone. Like if you come across as sort of condescending, like, oh, I can't believe you believe that. Or even like laughing, because I've seen that, that's proper aggressive. That if you're laughing at somebody like, haha, you're such an idiot. Like that is never going to go down well, no matter who it is. So it's important to keep, the tone of curiosity and that you're actually interested. Probably shouldn't feign that, but you should realize that there's always usually good reasons, or people feel like they have good reasons for believing the things they do. So it's good to try and figure out what those reasons are, as discussed in How to Have Impossible Conversations.
Absolutely. Yeah. All right. Well, then on to the next bit. So applications. Application number two, toasts that tantalize, and tributes and introductions too. Toasts, tributes, and introductions represent frequent opportunities for impromptu speaking at various events such as product launches, panels, weddings, funerals, or luncheons. In these moments, the natural inclination might be to worry about personal perception. However, these instances are not about the speaker, but rather about honoring and celebrating others, be they individuals, teams, or organizations. Such celebratory remarks, while sometimes seen as mere formalities, actually fulfill crucial roles. They provide a platform to express respect, appreciation, connection, and understanding towards the honorees. Moreover, they can establish the atmosphere for the event, guiding the audience's focus and setting expectations for subsequent speakers. In responding to requests for celebratory or commemorative speeches, Matt Abrahams recommends a structured approach known as the Watt Framework, aimed at crafting meaningful and impactful messages. He loves the Watt frameworks, doesn't he? The Watt Framework for toasts. W, why are we here? Start by clarifying the reason for gathering. This could be to celebrate a significant milestone, remembering a loved one, acknowledging a team's achievement, etc. Then H, how are you connected? Explain your relationship to the subject of the event. This helps establish your credibility and connection to the audience. A, anecdotes or learnings. Share relevant stories or lessons that highlight the qualities or contributions of the individual, team, or entity being honored. These anecdotes should be engaging, pertinent, and succinct. And T, thank. Conclude by expressing appreciation and extending good wishes to those being celebrated or remembered, reinforcing the positive sentiments of the occasion. I would say that's pretty, it's a pretty simple like kind of structure to follow.
It is very simple. I don't know if it's going to be very memorable personally if you do it this way, but I think it's really kind of there for the people, or at least in my head, if somebody randomly goes, like you're in a group setting and you happen to be one of the people's friends or something, and they just go, oh, speech. And it's like, oh, fuck, what do I say?
Yes, yeah.
At least if you have this in your mind, you can feel less anxious, I guess. Or you still feel anxious, let's be honest. But it's like, you know how you're going to structure it. And then it just comes a matter of, you know, filling out once again the steps.
Yes.
Because everybody knows the reason why they are there, how they're connected to the person. They know, obviously, or you would assume they would know at least one story for the connection with the person, and obviously thanking people. So I think for me, at least, it's maybe not, if you were preparing like a wedding speech, let's be honest, you wouldn't use that. But if you were put on the spot and you were shitting yourself, I think that's a very good start point.
Yes, I agree. I completely agree. I'm going to write that down.
Cool. So let's go into the sort of steps one by one. So step one, obviously, was about why the event. So the purpose of this event, you need to start by articulating the event's purpose from your perspective. This not only helps to foster the audience's attention, focus the audience's attention, but also sets the tone for what they can expect. By outlining the significance of the event, you have the opportunity to share your emotions, emphasize its importance, and kickstart the celebration or commemoration. Step two is the connection to the event, or your connection to the event. So it's likely that some attendees may not be familiar with who you are or your role in the event. So you've got to use this time to explain how you're connected to the individuals or the cause being honored. This is also an excellent opportunity to provide some background on the subjects of your speech, and if appropriate, incorporate a touch of humor.
Yeah.
Step three is sharing stories and insights. So this is where you deliver the core of your message, weaving in humor, emotional elements, and valuable lessons. Remember the guidance and storytelling. Ensure your anecdotes are structured, appropriate, concise, and have a clear message. Aim for a duration of a few minutes to maintain engagement without overstaying your welcome. And then the very last, which is the thanking. So step four, express gratitude. Wrap up your speech by extending your thanks to either the audience, those you're honoring, or both. This is also an opportune moment to add any further background details about the individuals, or the groups you're celebrating. It's pretty standard.
Yeah.
I guess always obviously depends on the event, like what you fill in. But I think as a general formula, it does the job. I haven't personally used it yet, but I'm gonna have to keep it in mind.
I'm gonna put you on the spot, mate. I will.
Fuck. Please don't. Next time.
Oh, funny. All right, well then the next section is slightly similar, so tips for giving toasts. So tip one, keep it concise. Aim for brevity in toasts, tributes, or introductions. Overly lengthy speeches tend to dilute the message you're trying to convey. Especially when you're among several speakers, consider how your message fits within the broader context of the events. Tip 2. Embrace emotion. Toasts and tributes often stir deep feelings, whether of joy, as in weddings or graduations, or sorrow, such as funerals or retirements. Prepare for the possibility of emotional overwhelm. If you suspect you might struggle to maintain composure, pre-arrange for someone to support you or have a closing remark ready to gracefully exit the stage. And tip 3, focus on the honoree. In storytelling, minimize the focus on yourself. Limit the use of I in your speech to ensure the spotlight remains on the individual or group being honored. Tip 4, ensure stories are inclusive and suitable. Choose anecdotes that all attendees can relate to and enjoy, ensuring the language and content are appropriate for the entire audience. Yeah. Tip 5.
You're quite wrong. What's if you're that? In the wrong place. It's like, you can imagine you're quite wrong if, like, a, you know, like a funeral or something, or like a or a wedding, and you just the wrong story, wrong place.
Oh, God. Yes. Yeah, you can imagine. Tip 5, promote harmony. In today's divided world, seek commonality in your public remarks. Aim to unite your audience with statements that resonate universally, without sacrificing your principles. Finding common ground is often more feasible than it seems. And then finally, tip 6, facilitate success for others. Consider your role as a precursor for subsequent speakers. Endeavor to create a conducive environment for their success, akin to clearing the runway for a smooth continuation of the event. Yeah, nice little framework that. I think I would definitely.
I was laughing at those two.
A toast or something.
I was just like laughing because I was thinking about, you know, like facilitating success for others, and it could be some like really boring guy, and you go like, "This guy is the funniest man I've ever met." We're bringing on to the stage Bob, and he's just really boring. Can you imagine just stitching somebody up?
Oh God, yes.
Oh dear.
I can kind of see these being used in like a like American Pie, or those kind of toasts, but then like taken and made humorous.
For sure. So that's application 2. So now we're moving on to application 3, which is about making pitches. So make that imperfect pitch. So Matt Abrahams emphasizes the importance of going beyond merely sharing thoughts, ideas, and opinions when spontaneously engaging with others. The objective often extends to persuading them to adopt our perspective or to take actions we deem beneficial. This can range from encouraging colleagues to embrace our ideas, convincing customers to purchase our products, persuading potential partners to accept first date invitations, urging our children to adjust their behavior and follow rules, to requesting neighbors to respect our property boundaries. So, to make a compelling argument that meets the audience's needs, Abrahams recommends employing a strategy known as problem solution benefit, which we roughly covered in the first part. So, problem: start by identifying a common challenge, issue, or pain point that your audience recognizes as their own. Solution: then introduce a solution by detailing the specific steps, processes, products, or methods designed to address the problem. And then benefit: so conclude by highlighting the benefits and improvements that result from adopting the proposed solution. Abraham points out this structured approach is effective in various scenarios where the goal is to persuade others. So to go into sort of a bit more detail, we've got the step one is stating the problem concretely. So you need to start by describing the problem in a straightforward and relatable manner, ensuring it's understandable to your audience. Consider presenting the issue as either an opportunity for improvement or directly as a challenge that needs addressing. For example, if encouraging a new workplace behavior, you might ask, "Are you tired of feeling undervalued and out of the loop with the team's activities?" That sounds pretty depressing, doesn't it? Highlight what makes the problem significant and think about the types of evidence. Think about the types of evidence that will resonate with your audience. It's also effective to discuss why the problem has been hard to solve, mentioning any specific obstacles. This approach not only emphasizes the problem's complexity, but also sets the stage for your solution to be seen as particularly effective because it overcomes these obstacles. Then moving on to step 2, you've got detail the solution. So offer a solution that is both practical and appropriate for the issue or opportunity you've outlined. Ensure your explanation is tailored to your audience, making it both clear and engaging. If the solution involves several steps or components, break these down into digestible parts to facilitate understanding. And the very last part, you've got step 3, so lay out the benefits. Detail the advantages of adopting your solution, starting with the most significant benefits and working down to the others. This prioritization helps underline the value your solution brings, and it makes a compelling case for its adoption. And it kind of makes sense. And I think with, especially with this last part, the benefits need to be obviously reordered depending upon who you're talking to, right? Because yes, each person might have a different thing that they, you know, perceive to be the most valuable with the solution that you're providing. So I guess to some extent with this, you kind of need to have at least some sort of pre-idea of what the problem actually is and what this person individually sees as the most valuable benefit before you obviously make the case. Because if you start like reeling off the stuff they care the least about, you're obviously going to put yourself in a bit of bother. They'll probably switch off by the time you get there.
Yeah, I agree.
And so I got a few bits here about the bonus structures. So this is another thing I took from the chapter. So when seeking backing for a startup or expanding business, you might want to structure your pitch with these prompts, which I thought were quite cool. What if you could insert like a dream state so that, for example, and that's not all. So an example of using this technique would be, what if you could streamline how you handle customer orders, enhancing both efficiency and personalization? This would mean, which is also the equivalent of, so that quicker delivery for your customers and faster payment for you. And then, for example, by utilizing our platform, company XYZ has boosted their order processing speed by 50% and now receives payments a week sooner. Additionally, customer satisfaction has significantly improved. But there's more. The insights we gather and analyze empower you to make precise recommendations, boosting your sales by encouraging customers to buy more from you. Which I thought was a really cool way of potentially structuring a sales pitch.
Yeah.
Because I feel like you can almost apply that structure to most things.
I think so. Yeah, absolutely. It sounds very salesy.
It does sound quite... I think it's the, wait, there's more, that gets me.
There's more. If you sign up now, then you will get...
Wait, there's more. It's like,
it's like the infomercials that you see on like the TV channels now and then. All right, so then tip one, use analogies. Oh no, wait, sorry, so utilizing analogies or comparisons can make complex ideas more accessible to your audience. By likening the importance or effect of the issue you're addressing to something familiar, you create a bridge of understanding. Similarly, when presenting a solution, like liken it to a known success in a different area. For example, a healthcare professional encouraging a lower carb diet might say, cutting down on carbs is similar to the benefits you saw from reducing your wine intake on weekdays. This approach makes the new concept more relatable and easier to grasp. And tip number two, offer consistent solutions. Demonstrating that your solution aligns with past successful actions or approaches to similar issues can increase audience acceptance. For instance, if you're making a case for a raise or promotion, reference examples of those or others who have earned such rewards for similar achievements. People tend to be more receptive to ideas that have a track record or success or recognizable precedent. I mean, that's kind of what happens in law when people just quote previous, you know.
It literally is. That's the precedent that's been set. Yeah.
Exactly. And tip three, frame benefits in positive terms. The way you word things can significantly impact your audience's reception. Matt Abrahams teaches that presenting benefits in a positive light can make a big difference. For instance, if a solution has been successful 75% of the time, highlight this success rate rather than mentioning a 25% failure rate. Matt Abrahams emphasizes the importance of focusing on what individuals stand to gain rather than lose, aligning with the concept of loss aversion. People generally prefer to avoid losses and risks, even if it means foregoing a potential benefit. To illustrate, consider the strategy of selling cars. Labeling a car as used might lead potential buyers to dwell on negative aspects like potential unreliability or costly repairs. However, if you describe the same car as previously enjoyed, this positive framing minimizes perceived risk and focuses on the car's value and charm, making it more appealing to buyers. This approach leverages positive framing to effectively engage and persuade your audience.
The worst thing about that is, can you imagine your girlfriend being referred to as previously enjoyed? I think you would just...
But imagine
I think used probably just as bad.
Yeah, used. Well, bloody hell! Yeah, this is my previously enjoyed girl. Oh, Jesus. Oh. I'm also wondering why in this scenario you'd be selling your girlfriend. So,
I just, sorry, the moment I had previously enjoyed it. So it's just like, oh my God.
Oh, funny. All right. Tip four, address the obstacles. In our efforts to persuade others, it's common to highlight only the positives of our proposal. However, acknowledging and addressing potential challenges is equally crucial. Ignoring these obstacles can diminish our credibility with our audience. Consider the frustration of being sold on seemingly perfect solutions only to realize it overlooks the real-world hurdles you face in implementing it. It's as if something desirable is being showcased just out of reach without any guidance on how to overcome the barriers to access it. This oversight can come across as insensitive and leaves you feeling disappointed and unsupported. I can't get your like bloody example out of my head now. I'm just applying it to everything.
Sorry, man. For anyone. Yeah, anything but like that.
Like something's just out of reach. I'm just picturing you with your previously enjoyed.
Got to remove these obstacles, mate.
Yeah. All right. And last tip. So tip number five, tone down the perfectionism. Embracing some imperfection when presenting your ideas can actually be beneficial. Baba Shiv, a marketing professor, notes that overly polished presentations often attract more scrutiny as audiences tend to look for faults. This skepticism is a natural response when evaluating new ideas. Shiv cites a well-known Silicon Valley adage to illustrate this point. Entrepreneurs seeking investment are more likely to receive just advice if they present their idea as flawless. However, if they approach investors seeking advice, acknowledging their concept's imperfections, they're more likely to secure funding. This approach suggests that acknowledging and being open about their areas for improvement in your idea can make it more appealing to potential backers.
Kind of makes sense, I guess. I mean, especially in that context, it shows they're going to be willing to listen to their expertise. Yeah. You know, if somebody comes in like, oh, my idea is the shit, they're going to be a bit like, well, yes and no, but it seems like you're not going to be receptive to feedback kind of thing. Yeah.
Mm. And also I think we naturally are inclined to think about the problems about something. So we'll already be on the lookout for it. If we are given that problem, there could be other problems, but we'll probably just accept that that's the problem and not go looking any further, if you get what I mean.
Yeah. It's quite interesting though that it would cause an increase in the chance of being funded.
Mm.
Yeah.
But I guess that's what, especially you're talking about a particular cohort of people. They are funding, which means that, you know, you don't just fund anything, like, and funders probably, you know, investors are looking for all of the probable issues.
And if it seems too good to be true, they're probably quite skeptical. I would have thought probably been burnt in the past by ideas like that. Okay, so moving on to another practical application number four, we got rocking the Q&A. So it's one thing to shine while giving a formal presentation, but how we can handle those less structured question and answer sessions that follow? And how can we handle impromptu questioning in meetings and one-on-one situations, such as interviews? So to effectively answer questions on the spot and enrich the audience's understanding, employ a straightforward strategy Matt Abraham refers to as ADD, ADD. So the ADD framework is answer the question. So start with a concise, straightforward answer in one clear sentence. D, detail an example, follow up with a specific tangible evidence that backs up your answer. Then D, again, describe the value. So conclude by highlighting the benefits, making clear why your response matters to the questioner. So crafting a response that includes a clear answer, a vivid example, and a benefit-oriented conclusion is key. Remember, it's the specific example that sticks with us, more than the vague statements, enhancing the listener's retention and comprehension. So let's go through this step by step. So we've got step one, directly answering the question. So immediately provide a straightforward answer to the question. Avoid lengthy introductions or unrelated information. Be direct and to the point. Avoiding the question or providing evasive answers can lessen your perceived honesty and trustworthiness, something that politicians could probably do well with reading. So step two, provide a supporting example. So select a relevant example that illustrates your point. Keep the details clear but concise to maintain interest without overwhelming or boring your audience. The right balance of detail will engage rather than distract. And the very last step, you've got to highlight the benefits and relevance. So do not assume the audience automatically grasps the significance of your answer. Explicitly state the key benefits and relevance of your response to the questioner. Clarifying the advantages helps underscore the value of your answer and enhances your perceived expertise. And I think especially in like interviews, for example, that might help, where maybe you're being hired for a very specific role and the person who happens to be interviewing you might not be so well versed in the specific skill. You know, the ability to talk about the results you achieved in the specific example, then explaining why it matters in a bigger business business context would sell yourself better. And it's actually this is one of my favorite of the frameworks. So I think it's so simple, but I can see the value in it massively, because it literally is just, you answer them, you give a great example, and then you literally tell them why the example matters. It doesn't really get much more simpler than that. And the logic flows very nicely, but I can see why it's a great structure. So yeah, then we've got, for this application, we've got some more tips to improve the structure. So we've got tip one, anticipate questions beforehand. So while the Q&A sessions may seem impromptu, a bit of foresight can enhance your readiness. So reflect on the potential questions related to the key points of your presentation or any challenging inquiries you anticipate. You need to consider the audience's background and interests to predict their questions. Preparing your responses using the ad framework not only makes you more convincing, but also allows you to use these moments to delve deeper into your subject matter. Tip number two, so strategically schedule the Q&A session. So Q&A doesn't always have to be a concluding act. If your presentation is segmented, introducing a Q&A session between sections can be a dynamic way to transition and re-engage your audience. Aim to interact with your audience every 10 minutes to maintain engagement and set clear expectations early on about when and how questions will be handled. Tip number three is establish clear Q&A guidelines. So you wield significant influence during Q&A sessions by setting clear expectations around the number of questions, the allocated time, and the scope of acceptable topics. Establishing these boundaries upfront empowers you to gracefully navigate or decline off-topic inquiries, maintaining the session's focus and effectiveness. I think it's quite a good one, isn't it? It's like, I'm only accepting questions about this. So if you ask me anything else, I'm not. And then when somebody asks you a stupid question, it's like, whatever. So tip number four, conclude the Q&A with impact. So ending a Q&A session on a strong note is crucial. Avoid lackluster closings by preparing a compelling final message that encapsulates the essence of your presentation. Crafting a memorable closing statement in advance ensures you leave the audience with a lasting impression. And then the very last tip is initiate it with your own question. Sounds quite fun, doesn't it? So sometimes sparking the first question from the audience can be challenging. If silence prevails, which it often does, don't hesitate to ask a prepared question yourself, one that highlights key insights or addresses common curiosities. This back pocket question can kickstart the dialogue and demonstrate your eagerness to engage. Use this opportunity to address potential improvements or challenges by showcasing your proactive approach and forward-thinking strategies. I quite like this a lot. It's like, instead of being, you know, because it's pretty common, I think, when people they open up questions to the floor, unless you've got a very confident audience. A lot of people, especially uni, I don't know if you had the same experience. Yes. Nobody wants to bloody ask a question or anything. So the ability to have like, well, these are the common questions I get asked, and then list go through a few, shows at least that you've come prepared. And that, I don't know, you're willing to engage with some of the, maybe even picking a really tough question, but like, this is one of the toughest questions I've ever had, and here's my answer.
Is a good point.
Sets a precedent.
Yeah, I really like that, actually. Yeah. Another good tip. All right, so moving on to the next section. Application 5, feedback that doesn't flop. By presenting feedback as a chance to work together on solutions, we can often get better immediate outcomes and strengthen our relationships over time. Focusing solely on sharing our opinions can create or reinforce a sense of hierarchy, making it harder for others to truly listen. If we act as if we're the final word on a subject, we put those we're giving feedback to in a passive role. At best, they get the message but lose the opportunity for teamwork. At worst, they might feel attacked or criticized, making them defensive or resistant. So the four I's. Number one, information. First, provide concrete, specific observations of the action or approach about which you will be providing feedback. Two, impact. Second, explain the effect the action or approach has on you. And three, invitation. Third, extend a collaboration request to address the action or approach on which you are providing feedback. And four, implication. Detail the positive and or negative consequences for adopting or not adopting the changes you are suggesting. And that seems pretty straightforward. Once again, like a lot of these kind of either acronyms or, you know, those strategies, they're pretty simple, but actually they sound quite effective.
Yeah. I think once again, for me, it's just the whole, it answers the question of how you're going to go about framing the information you're going to say, right? Or like, you know, hanging it up as the structure just provides you. Just like, well, first of all, I got to tell them the information about what it is that I'm going to be giving feedback. Then I got to talk about my feelings and the impact it has on me. Then I got to ask them, you know, how they feel about it. And then, you know, you got to talk about the implications, positive or negative, afterwards. It kind of, it just helps you, because I think we said it in the first part that the two problems is like what to say and how to say it. And I think a lot of people get overwhelmed in these situations because they're obviously feeling anxious as well, because maybe it's, you know, a tough situation where you're going to criticize somebody. Just having this in the back of your mind, like, I know the way I'm going to go about what I'm going to say. Because everybody, if you're going to get to the point of having the feedback session, you kind of know the content, you know what it is that you want to say, but you just don't know how to say it. And therefore this answers it.
Exactly. These little strategies that you can just have in your back pocket and that you can pick them out at any point. And it really allows you to, once again, it's that whole preparation thing. You know, if you've prepared this kind of structure and you know that you can apply it to certain things, yes, although you may not have applied it to the specific context with which you're going to use it in, but you can use it quite spontaneously because you're like, oh, I want to give feedback on someone. Actually, I've got this right here that I can follow.
Yeah. And for me, I think one of the big takeaways I would urge people to take from this podcast and the book would be that, to be honest, his structures are very useful and they are good, as we've covered, like some of them better than others. But the point being is that structures are kind of necessary. So you don't need to actually use his structures. You can create your own. You can be like, okay, I like the way that you go from, what was it there, information to impact. But maybe I want to change it around. Maybe I want to talk about the impact first. I don't know how that would go down, but you can try these things, right? You can create your own structures and the ways you do it. But the main point is, you need the structure, or you don't need it, but it will enhance your ability to go through these hard conversations and do these things if you have a structure in mind. And it doesn't have to be his. He even talks like, you know, you can, like a bit like the anxiety management plan, if you have the strategies and the points and the structure, like the other structures, you can sort of bring them all together and create your own one. I think that's what's important, and not the structures themselves.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I think that's a very good point. So here are some tips to keep in mind. Tip one. Prepare. Before giving feedback, it's beneficial to reflect on a few key questions, such as what might be driving the person's behavior that we find problematic? What are the consequences of providing feedback or choosing not to? And what specific changes in behavior are we hoping to see? And tip two, be timely. Feedback is most effective when it's timely. Addressing an issue soon after it occurs while ensuring emotions have cooled can lead to a more constructive outcome. That's so true. I think being tactful is actually a massive part of it. You'll know people who end up like bringing something up at the worst possible time.
Yeah. Or bringing it up like 3 months later. You remember when you didn't do that 3 months ago? It's like, fucking hell, right? Like, it's gone now. Come on.
Yeah, Jesus. Tip three, respect the context. The setting in which feedback is given is crucial. Consider if the environment and timing are appropriate for the feedback to be received well, taking into account the current circumstances of the person receiving it. So, yeah, if you're at a funeral and you need to ask someone a favor, it's probably not, you know, the best time to do it.
Or if they're in a super bad mood or something, it's like, why would you ask then? You know, if you can see somebody's visibly not in a good mood, it's not a good idea to ask them something.
Exactly. Tip four, adopt the right tone. The tone of our feedback can significantly affect its reception. Using the four I's framework can guide the tone to ensure it's received as intended. Tip five, stay balanced. Strive to balance critical feedback with positive reinforcement. Starting with a positive note can highlight the value you see in the person and their work, making them more open to constructive comments. And that's your thing that you always talk about, the shit sandwich, isn't it?
Yeah, oh yeah.
It's like, if you're going to give someone, like, you know, some critical feedback, then layer it with two kind of, you know, compliments.
Yeah.
Okay. Tip six, right?
Yeah, it is tip six, I believe.
Yeah, sorry. Tip six, monitor emotions. Be attentive to the recipient's emotional response to feedback. Signs of defensiveness or distress call for an adjustment in how the message is delivered. And tip seven, stay focused. When giving feedback, remember that less can be more. Offering too many points at once can overwhelm the recipient, making it hard for them to absorb and act on the feedback. Prioritize the most critical feedback to ensure clarity and effectiveness. And I think that last point is actually quite good. Like, you don't want to overwhelm the person with so much. Yeah.
I think it's huge, not even just the fact you don't want to overwhelm them, but you might also bring in stuff that's completely irrelevant. So like, oh, you're trying to argue about this or trying to tell them this, but you also have another list of things you want to also discipline them on, let's just say. But if you bring them all in once, they'll be a bit confused. Like, why are you dumping this all on me? Just like, let's focus on one and resolve the first thing first. And then, you know, bring up the next one another time, right? Because otherwise, I feel like it's really hard to solve three problems at the same time when it can just be, you know, focus on one, get that one done, then do another one, but give it some space.
Yeah. Completely agree.
Cool. Cool, 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 cool. So we are now on to the very last application, which is the secrets to saying we are sorry. So mastering the art of apologizing is an invaluable skill, particularly as we venture into more spontaneous interactions and strive to present our authentic selves. Yet many struggle with the nuances of delivering a sincere apology. In instances where we're inadvertently offended someone, an inept apology can exacerbate the issue, leaving feelings unresolved. So far from being a mark of vulnerability, offering a genuine apology is a demonstration of courage and integrity. It reflects a deep respect for our relationships, extending even to those with whom we are less familiar. It signifies, my God, am I saying it right? It signifies. Oh my God. I'm just throwing an F here, right center. It signifies, right. It signifies a willingness to prioritize harmony and mutual respect over pride, fostering a positive atmosphere for all involved. So this formula for apologies is the AAA formula, not to be confused with the roadside assistance. Acknowledge is the first one. First, identify the offending behavior and take responsibility for it. A, appreciate. Second, publicly accept how your offense has impacted others. And lastly, amend. Detail how you will make up for your offense, specifying what action you will take or refrain from taking to remedy the situation or how your thinking will change. I think the amends thing is pretty important because it's like, you know, fine, I know I've upset you and it's on me, you know, and I understand how it's upset you. But then if you don't say anything, that's like, how are you going to stop it from happening again? Especially if it's like a repeated offense.
Yeah.
It's almost like what's missing a lot from like, I was thinking about this the other day, only because I obviously recently read this and then saw, I can't remember what it was. Just
you had to apologize to someone.
No. It wasn't even me. I don't apologize. What are you on about? I'm going to start doing it now. But basically it was something on the news channel or something like that. It's somebody screwed up something classic. That's always that gets reported, right? And it's the classic like PR speech of like, we are always upholding, you know, diversity and, like, we always put our customers first, but it's like, okay, cool, you've apologized or whatever. And then you've said you always put your customers first, but you haven't detailed how you're going to amend it. You're just like, oh yeah, we always believe in, you know, treating people with respect. It's like, okay, well, have you actually put in like the amendments you're going to make? You know, people will believe it more if you literally just like, yeah, so what we've actually done after the back of this is we've decided we're going to retrain all our staff on this, this, and this because we believe, you know, customer satisfaction is important. Fucking amazing. You've literally described how you're going to do it, but nobody does that. They just pay lip service. And that is the problem with most apologies, is lip service without the action. And that's why I think this formula does it quite well. It's like acknowledging it, taking responsibility for it. So not trying to blame other people. Like, oh, I'm sorry for making you upset. It's like, I'm sorry I did that. I shouldn't have done it. I understand how you feel. You know, I would probably feel the same. What am I going to do about it? You know, it just sounds better. And I mean, just, I'm sure people who are listening could acknowledge or even just from a thought experiment, run through that and be like, if somebody did that to me, I would probably accept their apology. Obviously, depending, of course, what it fucking is, but you would feel a lot better at taking that as an apology than you would somebody not detailing how they're going to try and change the behavior that caused it in the first place. Or even worse, the whole, oh, I'm sorry that you're upset. You know, it's the whole, like, oh, it's your problem, you're upset, not mine. Which is like literally the worst apology, because it's not an apology.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it also, it incorporates the other person. When you lay out a plan, it incorporates them and they get to have a say in whether they think that the, you know, process that you're going to go through to, you know, apologize would actually work. You know, it's like, oh, okay, we understand that this was an issue and we're really sorry about that. We appreciate blah, 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 but this is how we're going to, this is the step plan to fix it. But it also incorporates the other person who's been at the, you know, other end of it, because they get to say, actually, that won't work, or, you know, I don't believe you. Or
yeah, you know, no, I didn't even think about that, but you're right. It allows them obviously to come in with that's probably not good enough. But also, I guess another thing as well is it signals that you've actually thought about what you've done. Because if you've thought about what you've done, you've then come up with a solution to the problem. It like showcases them that it's not only something that you've like, because, you know, it's so easy to just be like, yeah, you're right, I'm sorry. Like, fine, that is really easy to do at any time, right? Because it's just words. But the whole idea of, I've actually, you know, synthesized what you've said to me. I've understood my responsibility. I've figured out a potential, an amendment that I could do in my future behavior. They're going to be like, wow, like, this person's actually considered the perspective that I've said to them. Because you have to be able to create an amendment or a change or whatever you want to call it.
Exactly. Exactly. It makes a lot of sense.
So yeah, we've kind of just delved into it anyway, but we're going to go through the steps. So, step one, acknowledge the action and accept responsibility. So a true apology starts with a direct acknowledgement of the wrongful act and an acceptance of personal responsibility, which is the key part. So avoid non-apologies that deflect blame by saying things like, I'm sorry if what I said offended you, which insinuates that the issue lies with the other person's sensitivity rather than your actions. So instead of offering justifications or excuses for your behavior, it's crucial to specifically address what you did or failed to do. Genuine ownership of your actions is essential for the apology to be effective. And that's just so true. Step two, appreciate the impact. After identifying the regrettable action, the next step is to convey empathy towards those affected by it. It's important to communicate an understanding that your actions were not only wrong, but also harmful. Demonstrating awareness of the full scope of the impact, including the emotional distress caused, is vital for showing the person affected that you truly comprehend the consequence of your actions. Followed by the very last part.
I think that's huge, that one.
Yeah, which bit, sorry?
I think just that in general is like showing that you actually understand your actions rather than just saying, yeah, I'm sorry, you know. It signals to the other person that you truly, well, you know the proper consequences of your actions, you know.
Yeah, for sure. And then step three, detail how you will make amends. So an apology needs to go beyond merely taking responsibility and empathizing with the affected party. It must also include a commitment to making amends. Without outlining specific steps you intend to take to prevent a recurrence of the issue, the apology may seem insincere, which is probably why a lot of the sort of, you know, the media PR apologies, people just go like, it's just lip service because there's no plan. So here we go.
Yeah.
Detailing your plan to rectify the situation and prevent future instances not only underscores the sincerity of your apology, but also opens the door for accountability. Boom. Another thing that's missing from these, you know, lip service apologies you get across the world. Like, don't even realize they made a mistake. They usually make some bullshit excuse. They then don't empathize at all, because if they had to empathize, they'd be like, oh wow, I accidentally killed, you know, all these people. Oh shit, you know, oh, I can empathize with that. My granddad died or some shit. And then don't actually say anything about a plan. It's just the classic. I'm just getting angry. Think about it. The absolute fucking classic. Oh, we uphold it. We take our social responsibility very seriously. It's one of our core, you know, principles of the business. Yeah. And that's it. It's like, there's no change. It's just like, it's in our mission statement, so we care. It's oh my God, you are so stupid. I can write a fucking mission statement with all this. It's like, it's the actions that actually matter. Oh, got it. Fucks me off.
And once again, like going back to what we were talking about before, when you provide a plan and it shows whether it's worthy of the apology, of the other person accepting your apology, right? When you see like all of this, you know, when all these companies where some company will like poison the water and then all these people get ill and get cancer and die, and they're like, we're really sorry about this, yes, we're going to make sure that we get on top of this straight away. It's not enough, right? Like you need something that is worthy of being forgiven. And that's another reason, I think, when you put out that plan, that it shows whether it's worthy or not.
For sure. And I think the important part here, which we talked about earlier, which is that you can first of all criticize the plan. Like you said, it'd be like, that's not enough. But they can also, I like the idea of the accountability, actually. Like, you said you're going to do this. So where's the proof in a year's time? Like, give us proof. Yeah. Like, fine, cool, great, you're going to do this. But we need the proof that you've actually done this. You know, it's not like, oh, we uphold, you know, diversity in our business principles. Okay, like, how have you actually fucking done that? Like, how have you actually taken action on these, like, core principles you claim to have? Yeah. Always just words, which is why everybody gets so annoyed with the sort of PR speak. It's just like, you've just done lip service, and that's one of the most annoying things ever, because it's just not an apology. It's just not a change. It's just
exactly.
Yeah, we take it very seriously.
It's treating them as stupid, you know?
Yeah, no, it is. Yeah, it is. And people are so much more intelligent than people but people are so much smarter than people give them credit for. They're looking for deception. Like, we are built to look for like slights and people trying to lie to us, right? That's part of our like evolutionary heritage, to try and pick out like cheaters. So everybody's really good at like finding that stuff, and they just see the media and think, fuck me, what are these, like, why are these guys saying the same things again and again and again, and think we're gonna believe it every time they say it without meaningful action plans which they can be held accountable against.
All right, well, on to the last section then. So this last bit here are some further thoughts on how you might enhance your use of the AAA and improve the impact of your apologies. So tip one, don't pre-apologize. Offering an apology in anticipation of a mistake, such as being late or potentially offending, might seem considerate, but often raises questions about...
Sorry, I'm going to cheat on you.
Yeah. Hello, previously enjoyed girlfriend. I'm about to sell you. I hope you're okay with that. For instance, saying, I might be 30 minutes late, so I apologize in advance, might make other questions why adjustments weren't made to prevent the delay if you were aware of it beforehand. Pre-apologies can inadvertently highlight the forthcoming error, making it more likely for others to notice and remember it. That's a good point. Tip two, don't wait too long to apologize. While apologizing late is better than never apologizing, timing is crucial. Immediate circumstances might not always allow for an instant apology, such as needing to wait until a meeting concludes or until you see someone again. However, delaying an apology for too long can compound the issue. So it's important to find the right moment to express your regret sincerely and appropriately. And finally, tip three, be specific, clear, and brief. A concise and straightforward apology often suffices. Over-apologizing, driven by guilt or anxiety, can overwhelm the recipient and dilute the sincerity of your message. It's not necessary to repeatedly apologize or offer apologies for a minor or inconsequential action. Apologies should be reserved for meaningful errors, ensuring they retain their significance. Adopting a measured approach to apologizing helps maintain the impact and value of your words. And I think that's quite a good point. You don't want to dilute the value of your apologies by constantly making them all the time for the smallest of things, or over-apologizing all the time.
It definitely loses its like strength if you just, you know, say sorry for every sort of minor slight.
Yes, absolutely.
Cool. So that was part two of Think Faster, Talk Smarter. So we covered small talk, toasts, pitches, Q&As, giving feedback, as well as apologizing. I'm sure people would have found something useful from that, because there's so many different tips and tricks. Once again, it's probably overwhelming to try and, you know, apply all of these. Maybe stick to one. And as mentioned, I think in the previous part one, you definitely listen to that if you haven't already. There's a part around about practicing these structures. So a great way of doing it would be either using like your mind to think of something you might apologize for, let's just say, or using ChatGPT or any sort of Google search to find you problems that you could then put into these structures to try and practice using them on the fly. Because the only way you're going to get good at using these is by repeatedly doing it in practice. But I'm hoping, having listened to this, you will all understand the value of having these structures sort of at the back of your mind whenever you come across these situations where you may need to use them. Because, you know, just from reading it, I mean, I personally haven't used too many of them yet. I tried the now, so what was it? What? Now what? So what? Whatever it was. I've tried that a couple of times and it's worked, at least from my perspective of trying to frame information. But it's definitely something you should at least pick one or two. That's what I do, and start practicing.
Yes. Yeah, I think that's wise. Don't overwhelm yourself by taking on too much. But I do think it is good. And like you said, you know, these structures that he lays out within the book, they don't have to be taken, you know, word for word. You can create your own kind of structures, but the concept is there. You know, you can prepare by having a bunch of these structures at your disposal so that you can whip them out at a certain point in time when it's appropriate. And and then it will just help you communicate a lot more effectively.
Yes, and hopefully it'll give you confidence to be able to communicate on the sort of off the cuff, because that's probably one of the hardest to do, especially as your emotions will take over and you'll feel anxious, etc. So,
Well, it will help you everything. Think smarter and talk faster. No, is that it?
No, so no,
think faster, talk smarter. I fucking get these two mixed up all the time.
Mate, trust me, that's why I had to write it down, or else I forget it, because,
I tried to do a hot tub time machine moment just there by looking into the camera and clearly just fucked it. So
I did it. So
anyways.
Try it again. Come on. Take two.
Yeah. All right. So that's for think faster, talk smarter.
Yeah, you got it. Fantastic. I don't know what we're doing next, but we got plenty more in the pipeline for the communication books. We might redo the How to Have Impossible Conversations. I've got the book I wanted to do with you, Win Every Argument, which is very good. And then there's plenty more. Plenty more. So stay tuned. Yeah,
so many on the go.